Chapter 5. Slow. "Could you hand me the oximeter?" Olson asked from across the dining room table. "It's afternoon on the fifth day of the recovery phase, and for the past 30 minutes we've been testing our blood gases, heart rates, and other vital signs. This is the 45th time we've been through this drill in the past 2 weeks." Although both Olson and I feel utterly transformed while nasal breathing, the monotony of the days is becoming maddening. We're eating the same food at the same time as we did 10 days earlier, sweating through the same stationary bike workouts in the same gym, having many of the same conversations. This afternoon, we're discussing Olson's favorite subject, his obsession for the past decade. We are, once again, talking about carbon dioxide. It's hard to admit now, but when I first interviewed Olson more than a year ago, he was not a source I entirely trusted. On our Skype calls, he'd like to hammer the importance of slow breathing. Now, this part made sense to me, but when he started in on the restorative wonders of a toxic gas, I began to wonder. "I really think carbon dioxide is more important than oxygen," he told me. Olson claimed that we have 100 times more CO2 in our bodies than oxygen, which is true, and that most of us need even more of it, which is also true. He said it wasn't oxygen, but huge quantities of carbon dioxide that fostered the burst of life during the Cambrian explosion 500 million years ago. He said that today humans can increase this toxic gas in our bodies and sharpen our minds, burn fat, and heal disease. After a while, I began to worry that Olson was nuts, or at least prone to gross exaggeration, and that our hours and hours of conversations had been a total waste of time. Carbon dioxide, after all, is a metabolic waste product. It's the stuff that plumes out of coal plants and rotten fruit. Every other day, there's a new headline detailing how Earth was warming because there was too much CO2 in the atmosphere. Animals were dying. Carbon dioxide kills. Olson kept arguing the opposite. He insisted that CO2 could be beneficial, and he warned me that having too much oxygen in my body wouldn't help me, but hurt me. "Breathing heavy, breathing quickly and as deeply as you can, I realize this is the worst advice anyone could give you," Olson told me. Big, heavy breaths were bad for us because they depleted our bodies of, yes, carbon dioxide. Several months of this back and forth got me intrigued enough, or confused enough, or both, that I decided to fly to Sweden. My hope was to spend a few days with Olson and see his operation in an attempt to learn more about one of the most misunderstood gases in the universe. I arrived in Stockholm in mid-November and took a train to an industrial co-working space on the outskirts of town. Through the windows of a cavernous lobby, the sunlight had a kind of slant to it. Ominous clouds gathered, and the air was thick with the heavy feeling that precedes a long winter. Olson showed up exactly on time, took a seat across from me, and placed a glass on the table. He wore faded jeans, tennis shoes, and a pressed white shirt. He had that kind of calm you see in monks or Amish or others who spend a lot of time in their inner worlds. When he spoke, was always softly, with that annoying habit that all Scandinavians seem to have inherited, flawless English, with no ums or huhs or pauses. He'd even gotten his whoms down and inserted the oft-forgotten not when he told me how he could care less. "I was going to end up exactly like my father," Olson said, running a finger along the glass. He told me how his father had been chronically stressed, how he breathed too much, how he'd gotten severe high blood pressure and lung disease and died at 68 with the tube in his mouth. "I knew that so many other people were going to stay sick and die of the same thing," Olson explained. He wanted to educate himself so that he'd be prepared if something else happened to him or his family. After the long days he spent running a software distribution company, Olson came home and read medical books. He'd call up doctors, surgeons, and scientists. Eventually, he sold his business, got rid of his nice cars and big house, got a divorce, and moved into a condominium. Then he scaled down to a smaller apartment and spent 6 years forgoing any salary, working almost entirely alone, trying to understand the mysteries of health and medicine and the role of carbon dioxide in the body. There were yogi books about prana, and then there were medical books focusing on pathologies, blood gases, and disease, and CPAP, he told me. In short, Olson had found what I'd found, but years earlier, that there was a gap in our knowledge about the science of breathing and its role in our bodies. He discovered we'd done a good job of examining what causes breathing problems, but done little to explore how they first develop and how we might prevent them. Doctors had been complaining about this for decades. The field of respiratory physiology is expanding in all directions, yet so preoccupied have most physiologists been with lung volumes, ventilation, circulation, gas exchange, the mechanics of breathing, the metabolic cost of breathing, and the control of breathing, that few have paid much attention to the muscles that actually do the breathing, one physician wrote in 1958. What many of these doctors found, what Olson would discover much later, was that the best way to prevent many chronic health problems, improve athletic performance, and extend longevity was to focus on how we breathe, specifically to balance oxygen and carbon dioxide levels in the body. To do this, we need to learn how to inhale and exhale slowly. How could inhaling smaller amounts of air and having more CO2 in our bloodstream increase oxygen in our tissues and organs? How could doing less give us more? To understand this contrarian concept, you need to consider the body parts beyond the nose and mouth. The purpose of those 25,000 inhales and exhales we take daily lies deeper inside of us. And the farther we follow this air, the more surprising and strange this journey gets. Your body, like all human bodies, is essentially a collection of tubes. There are wide tubes, like the throat and sinuses, and very thin tubes, like the capillaries. The tubes that make up the tissues in the lungs are very small, and we've got a ton of them. If you line them all up, they'd reach from New York City to Key West, more than 1,500 miles. Each breath you take must travel down the throat, past the crossroads called the tracheal carina, then splits into the right and left lungs. As it keeps going, that breath gets pushed into smaller tubes until it dead ends at little bulbs called alveoli. What happens next is very complicated and confusing. An analogy might help. Let's say you're about to take a river cruise. You're in a waiting room at the dock when a ship arrives. You pass through security, board the ship, and head off. This is similar to the path oxygen molecules take once they reach the alveoli. Each alveolus functions as a little docking station for each molecule of oxygen. As the O2 passes through the alveolus walls, it lodges into a red blood cell, a kind of cruise ship that carries it off deeper into the body. This cruise ship is filled with its own guest rooms. In your blood cells, those rooms are the protein called hemoglobin. As blood flows through the tissues and muscles, oxygen will disembark while another passenger will board. That passenger is carbon dioxide. Once filled, the red blood cell will begin its journey back to the lungs. This exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide changes the appearance of blood. Blood with more CO2 in it will appear blue. Blood still filled with oxygen will appear red. It's these gases that give veins and arteries their distinctive colors. Eventually, the cruise ship will make its round around the body and back to port, back to those lungs, where all the carbon dioxide will exit and new oxygen passengers will board. Then the process starts all over again. Every healthy cell in the body is fueled by oxygen, and this is how it's delivered. The entire cruise takes about a minute, and the overall numbers are staggering. Inside each of our 25 trillion red blood cells are 270 million hemoglobin, each of which has room for 4 oxygen molecules. That's a billion molecules of O2 boarding and disembarking within each red blood cell cruise ship. There's nothing controversial about this process of respiration and the role of carbon dioxide in gas exchange. This is all basic biochemistry. What's less acknowledged is the role of carbon dioxide in weight loss. That CO2 we release with every breath has weight, and we exhale more weight than we inhale. The way the body loses weight isn't through profusely sweating or burning it off. We lose weight through exhaled breath. For every 10 pounds of fat lost in our bodies, 8.5 pounds comes off through the lungs. The rest is sweated or urinated out. This is a fact most doctors, nutritionists, and other medical professionals have historically gotten wrong. The lungs are the weight-regulating system of the body. "Everyone always talks about oxygen," Olson told me during our interview in Stockholm. "Whether we breathe 30 times or 5 times a minute, a healthy body will always have enough oxygen." What our bodies really want, what they require to function properly, isn't faster or deeper breaths. It's not more air. What we need is more carbon dioxide. More than a century ago, a baggy-eyed Danish physiologist named Christian Bohr discovered this in a laboratory in Copenhagen. Bohr was fascinated with respiration. He knew that oxygen was the cellular fuel and that hemoglobin was the transporter. He knew that when oxygen went into a cell, carbon dioxide came out. But Bohr didn't know why this exchange took place. Why did some cells get more O2 more easily than others? What directed billions of hemoglobin molecules to release oxygen at just the right place, at just the right time? How did breathing really work? He began experimenting. Bohr gathered chickens, guinea pigs, grass snakes, dogs, horses, and more, and he measured how much oxygen the animals consumed, how much carbon dioxide they produced. Then he drew blood and exposed it to different mixtures of these gases. Blood with the most CO2 in it loosened oxygen from hemoglobin. In some ways, carbon dioxide worked as a kind of divorce lawyer, a go-between to separate oxygen from its ties so it could be free. This discovery explained why certain muscles used during exercise received more oxygen than lesser-used muscles. They were producing more CO2, which attracted more oxygen. It was a supply and demand on a molecular level. Carbon dioxide also had a profound dilating effect on blood vessels, opening these pathways so they could carry more blood to hungry cells. Breathing less allowed animals to produce more energy more efficiently. Meanwhile, just a few moments of heavy breathing above our metabolic needs could reduce blood flow. We'll feel lightheaded, cramp up, get a headache, and even black out. If our tissues were denied constant flow for too long, they'd break down. In 1904, Bohr published a paper about all this. It was a sensation among scientists and inspired a flurry of new research into carbon dioxide. Soon after, a Yale physiologist named Yandell Henderson began his own set of experiments. Henderson, too, had spent the last several years studying metabolism, and like Bohr, he was convinced that CO2 was as essential to the body as any vitamin. Although clinicians still find it hard to believe, oxygen is in no sense a stimulant to living creatures, Henderson would write. If a fire is supplied with pure oxygen instead of air, it burns with enormously augmented intensity. But when a man or animal breathes oxygen or air enriched with oxygen, no more of that gas is consumed. No more heat is produced, and no more carbon dioxide is exhaled than when air alone is breathed. For a healthy body, overbreathing or inhaling pure oxygen would have no benefit, no effect on oxygen delivery to tissues and organs, and could actually create a state of deficiency. In other words, the pure O2 a quarterback might huff between plays, or that a jet-lagged traveler might shell out $50 for at an airport oxygen bar, don't do anything. Inhaling the gas might increase blood O2 levels 1 or 2%, but that oxygen will never make it to hungry cells. We'll simply breathe it back out. To prove his point, over the years, Henderson conducted a number of awful experiments on dogs that are about as difficult to read as Harvard's awful experiments on monkeys. For people sensitive to this kind of thing, you might want to forward the next 2 minutes. Henderson placed individual dogs on a table, fitting their faces with a rubber mask. At the end of the tube was a hand bellows. The contraption allowed Henderson to control how much air each dog took in and how often. A suite of instruments recorded heart rate, carbon dioxide, oxygen, and more. As Henderson pumped the bellows faster and faster, he watched the heart rates of the animals quickly increase from 40 up to 200 beats a minute. The dogs would eventually have so much oxygen flowing through their arteries, with so little carbon dioxide to offload it, that their bodies began failing. Dogs would spasm uncontrollably or drift into a coma. If Henderson kept pumping more air, the animals would become so full of O2 and so deficient of CO2 that they died. Henderson killed dogs with their own breath. With the dogs that survived, he would pump the bellows a little slower and watch as their heart rates immediately decreased to 40 beats per minute. It wasn't the act of breathing that sped up and slowed the dogs' hearts. It was the amount of carbon dioxide flowing through their bloodstream. Henderson then forced the dogs to breathe just slightly harder than normal, just above their metabolic needs. This was a condition of mild hyperventilation common in humans. The dogs grew agitated, confused, anxious, and glassy-eyed. The slight overbreathing was inducing the same confused state that occurred during altitude sickness or panic attacks. Henderson gave the dogs morphine and other drugs to slow their heart rates. These drugs worked partly because, as Henderson observed, they helped raise carbon dioxide levels. But there was another way to restore the animals to health. Let them breathe slowly. Whenever Henderson lowered the breathing rates, all that twitching, the stupors, the anxiety went away. The dogs stretched out and relaxed, their muscles loosened, and a peacefulness washed over them. Carbon dioxide is the chief hormone of the entire body. It is the only one that is produced by every tissue and that probably acts on every organ, Henderson later wrote. Carbon dioxide is, in fact, a more fundamental component of living matter than is oxygen. I spent 3 days with Olson in Stockholm. We pored over tables and graphs and talked about Bohr and Henderson and other storied pulmonauts. By the end of my trip, I finally understood how my own view of breathing had been so limited and so wrong for so many years. And I finally understood how Olson had become so obsessed with this line of research, how he'd given up his life as a software tycoon and downgraded to such a tiny apartment, why he'd spent so many months recording breathing techniques, how they affected his blood pressure and energy and stress levels. I understood why only one person showed up for the first conference he held in 2010, and why after honing his message and building his research base, he was now something of a Swedish media star, his grinning, perpetually tanned, rom-com face showing up in newspapers, magazines, and nightly news shows. In these interviews, he beseeched audiences with the same message of slow breathing. I returned home to San Francisco, and Olson and I kept in touch. Every few weeks, I get a new email or a call about some long-lost scientific discovery he'd just unearthed. He'd continued his self-experimentation, too, always seeking to use his own body to prove the power of breathing and the wonders of that metabolic waste product, carbon dioxide. This is how Olson ended up, a year later, in my living room in San Francisco, with a face mask velcroed to his head and an electrode clipped to his ear. "Can you hand me the oximeter, please?" Olson says from across the table. We've just finished our afternoon testing, and Olson is re-strapping himself into the Breath IQ, a prototype of a device that measures CO2, ammonia, and other elements in exhaled breath. He clips a pulse oximeter to his finger and starts counting down the seconds. "Maybe it's the carbon dioxide and the nitric oxide boost from nasal breathing, but we're feeling punchy today. In addition to the $5,000 we dropped on x-rays and pulmonary tests at Stanford, Olson and I also managed to amass several thousand dollars worth of equipment at our own home lab. We've spent 2 weeks running tests and have yet to push the throttle on it. That's changing today." Olson wipes a hand on his Abercrombie sweatshirt and scoots over so that I can see the readouts on the machines. All vitals are normal. Heart rate, around 75. Blood pressure, around 126. Oxygen levels at 97. 3, 2, 1, he begins breathing, but slowly, very slowly. He inhales and exhales about 3 times slower than that of the average American, turning those 18 breaths a minute into just 6. As he sips air through his nose and out through his mouth, I watch as his carbon dioxide levels rise. They keep rising. A minute later, Olsen's levels are 25% higher than they were just a few minutes ago. All the while, his blood pressure drops and his heart rate sinks to the mid-60s. What hasn't changed is his oxygen. From start to finish, even though he's breathing at a third of the rate of what's considered normal, his oxygen levels have stayed the same, steady at 97%. We've experienced the same confounding measurements during our bike workouts earlier in the week. The beginning of these workouts, like all workouts, sucked. We felt our lungs desperately trying to meet the needs of our hungry tissues and muscles. This is the dinner rush of the body. Normally, I'd open my mouth and huff and puff, trying to sate that nagging need. But for the last several days, I cranked the pedals harder and faster while I forced myself to breathe slower and slower. This felt stifling and claustrophobic, like I was starving myself of fuel. But then I checked the pulse oximeter. Once again, no matter how slowly I breathed or how hard I pedaled, my oxygen levels stayed steady. It turns out that when breathing at a normal rate, our lungs will absorb only about a quarter of the available O2 in the air. The majority of that oxygen is exhaled back out. By taking longer breaths, we allow our lungs to soak up more with less. On the second day of using the slower nasal breathing approach, I'd outdistanced my mouth breathing record by a 13th of a mile. The next session, I pedaled a 5% increase over mouth breathing. By my 5th ride on the stationary bike, I pedaled 7.7 miles, almost a full mile longer in the same amount of time, using the same amount of energy than I had previously in the week. This was a significant gain. During that ride, I started playing around with my breathing. I tried to inhale and exhale even slower and slower. I immediately felt that sense of air hunger and claustrophobia. I looked down at the pulse oximeter to see just how much oxygen I was losing, how starved my body had become. But my oxygen levels hadn't decreased with these slow breaths as I or as anyone else might expect. They kept rising. A last word on slow breathing. It goes by another name, prayer. When Buddhist monks chant their most popular mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, each spoken phrase lasts 6 seconds, with 6 seconds to inhale before the chant starts over again. The traditional chant of Om takes 6 seconds to sing, with a pause of about 6 seconds to inhale. The Sata Nama chant, one of the best-known techniques in Kundalini Yoga, takes about 6 seconds to vocalize, followed by 6 seconds to inhale. Japanese, African, Hawaiian, Native American, Buddhist, Taoist, Christian, all these cultures and all these religions had somehow developed the same prayer techniques, requiring the same breathing pattern, and they all benefited from the same calming effect. In 2001, researchers at the University of Pavia in Italy gathered 2 dozen subjects, covered them with sensors to measure blood flow, heart rate, nervous system feedback. Then they had them recite a Buddhist mantra, as well as the original Latin version of the Ave Maria. The researchers were stunned to find that the average number of breaths for each cycle was almost exactly identical, just a bit quicker than the pace of those Hindus, Taoists, and Native American prayers. It was 5.5 breaths a minute. But what was even more stunning was what breathing like this did to the subjects. Whenever they followed this pattern, blood flow to the brain increased and the systems of the body entered a state of coherence, where the heart, circulation, and nervous system are coordinated to peak efficiency. The moment the subjects returned to spontaneous breathing or talking, their heart rates would beat a little more erratically, and the integration of these systems would slowly fall apart. A few more slow and relaxed breaths, and it would return again. A decade after the Pavia test, two renowned professors and doctors in New York, Patricia Gerbarg and Richard Brown, used the same breathing pattern on patients with anxiety and depression, minus the praying. Some of these patients had trouble breathing this slowly, so Gerbarg and Brown recommended they start with an easier rhythm of just 3-second inhales with at least the same length exhale. As the patients got more comfortable, they breathed in and breathed out longer. It turns out that the most efficient breathing rhythm for the body occurs when both the length of respirations and the total breaths per minute are locked in a spooky symmetry. 5.5-second inhales followed by 5.5-second exhales, which works out almost exactly to 5.5 breaths per minute. Even when practiced for just 5 or 10 minutes a day, the results can be potent. I've seen patients transformed by adopting regular breathing practices, said Brown. He and Gerbarg even used the slow breathing technique to restore the lungs of 9/11 survivors who suffered from a chronic cough caused by debris. There was no known cure for this ailment, and yet after just 2 months, patients achieved a significant improvement by simply learning to practice a few rounds of slow breathing. Did it matter if we breathed at a rate of 5 or 6 seconds or were a half second off? It did not, as long as the breaths were in the range of 5.5. In many ways, the resonant breathing offered the same benefits of meditation for people who didn't want to meditate, or yoga for people who didn't want to get off the couch. It offered the healing touch of prayer for people who weren't religious. The Pavia researchers wrote, "We believe that the rosary may have partly evolved because it synchronized with the inherent cardiovascular Mayer rhythms and thus gave a feeling of well-being and perhaps an increased responsiveness to the religious message." In other words, the meditations, Ave Marias, and dozens of other prayers that have been developed over the past thousands of years weren't all baseless. Prayer really heals, especially when it's practiced at 5.5 breaths a minute.